Welcome everyone to our first session, which will be on second order cell force problem with Adam Pound from the University of Southampton, starting off talking about progress towards post-adiabatic waveforms.
Okay, just let me share my screen. All right, can you see and hear me?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so I've gotten quite terrible at timing these things, so I'll probably be pretty tight on time, but I'll try to get through everything. I'm going to be talking about a fairly big research program, which is why I'm listing about 20 collaborators here. That's aimed really at eventually getting post-adiabatic waveforms. Okay, so for anyone who missed Martin's talk on the first day, what do we mean by adiabatic and post-adiabatic? Well, this is terminology that was devised by Hinderer and Flanagan in 2008. So the idea is we're starting off with an asymptotic expansion in the small mass ratio, which I'll call epsilon. So we have the exact metric of the binary, which we expand out in powers of the mass ratio. And what Hinderer and Flanagan found is that on the inspiral timescale, so the long timescale that it takes for the inspiral to occur, the gravitational wave phase has an expansion like this. So it starts off at 1 over epsilon order, basically because it's growing roughly linearly with time. Then there's a small correction, well, not small, order one correction. Then there's a genuinely small correction. So this leading term is what's called adiabatic order. And to calculate it, all you need is the averaged dissipative piece of the first order self force. So force coming from this H1. Then this term here is called post-adiabatic or first post-adiabatic order. You can imagine going to the next order and getting second post-adiabatic and so forth. And to get this piece, you need the averaged dissipative piece of the second order force coming from H2. And you need the entirety of the conservative and oscillatory pieces of the first order force. So you need all of F1 and part of F2. And of course, you know, people are always looking at various effects that they think are going to be measurable because they have an order one effect on the phase. But we're never going to be able to measure any of those things unless we have this term in our basic pure GR model. So this is essential to do the kind of high accuracy science we hope to do with Lisa. Okay, there's also other motivations to get these post-adiabatic waveforms and to do second order calculations in general. So there's been a long history over the last 10 to 15 years of using self-force data to determine parameters or higher order terms in other methods of modeling binaries. So for example, in post-Newtonian dynamics in particular, and now there's the prospect of doing it for post-Minkowskian dynamics. There was this nice paper, actually a couple of papers by Beeny, Damore, and I'm going to butcher the name, Garalico, a couple of years ago, who showed that if you did a second order self-force calculation, you would fully fix the 5PN dynamics and the 6PM dynamics. It's a very high order. Of course, you've got to do the right calculation to get that information. I think also we have pretty conclusive evidence now over the last few years, and Niels Warburton will show even, I think, even more conclusive evidence later today, that if we had a post-adiabatic model working, we could easily use it to directly model IMRIs, at least in some regions of the parameter space, so at least for quasi-circular orbits. I think there should be no question about that. Obviously, it depends on signal to noise, what your accuracy requirements are, but I expect it to be extremely accurate. Okay, so this is the kind of binary parameter space picture we've all seen. And the idea is we've always, or people have thought that cell force theory is tucked away into the corner, but increasingly we know it actually pushes pretty far to the left into the comparable mass regime. Okay, so how do we actually get this post-adiabatic model? So first, what's the basic starting point we're coming from? That's the second order expansion of the Einstein equations with a small body in the spacetime. So all of this doesn't care what spacetime you're in. This is valid for any spacetime. And the basic idea is you have some kind of skeletonization of your small object, which is derived from matched asymptotic expansions. And you replace the small object with a puncture, which is a singularity that moves around in your manifold. So that's kind of a generalization of a point particle. And at first order, it's completely equivalent to just a point particle stress energy. At second order, in a specific class of gauges, it's still equivalent to that, but that's a very special class of gauges. So the puncture method is a bit more general. So the idea is you take part of the metric representing the field of the small body near the small body, and you move it to the right-hand side of the field equations, and you solve for the remainder, which is called the residual field. And the puncture that you've moved to the right-hand side is singular. It behaves like this. So the first order puncture diverges as one over distance as you get close to the body's world line. The second order puncture diverges as one over distance squared, so more strongly, and it keeps going up, more and more divergent as you go up in the orders. But the sources over here are such that the sources are actually smooth or sufficiently smooth, even though the punctures are singular. And then once you've calculated this residual field, you put that into the equation of motion that you derive, and you evolve the world line that the puncture is moving on. So here we've got a first order field equation that's just sourced by a puncture, and a second order field equation that's got a puncture, and it's got quadratic combinations of the first order field. And this is not H1R, this is the full first order field. Okay. Now, as I said, that's valid in any spacetime. How are we going to get it into a nice practical form in the spacetime we're interested in, which is Kerr? So first, let's think of what's typically done at first order. So at first order, what is usually done is you just fix the motion to be a geodesic. And so you have some constants of motion. You have the energy, the angular momentum, and the Carter constant. Then you also have, of course, the mass and the spin of the big black hole. But I'm going to put those aside. And then you find that the motion is tri-periodic. It has three characteristic frequencies. And because of that, the first order metric perturbation has a discrete Fourier spectrum. So you've got these coefficients in your Fourier series that depend on your system parameters. And then you've got the rapidly oscillating phases with geodesic frequencies multiplied by time. And so you solve for these coefficients in a frequency domain decomposition of the field equations. And what's kind of underlying this description is a description of the geodesic motion in this form, where you've got a set of constants, EL and C, or EL and Q sometimes written. So these are not evolving in time. And then you've got these phases that are just the frequencies times Bori-Lindquist time. So these things are just frequency times time. But we can think of those as action angle variables for the dynamics. And so they satisfy this equation where they have constant frequency that's determined entirely by these constants of motion. So how does that generalize once we're taking into account evolution and cell force? Thanks. So we use a two time scale expansion. The most detailed description of this is in this book chapter by myself and Barry Wardell from earlier this year. There will be more work coming out sometime soon, hopefully. But the idea is we still just have the same system parameters for the orbit, and now I've added two slowly evolving corrections to the black hole mass and spin. And all these guys are now going to be evolving slowly. But the two time scale expansion for the metric perturbation looks just like the Fourier series that we had for the geodesic motion. We've got these coefficients that depend on the system parameters, and we've got a Fourier series in the action angles. So now these guys are slowly evolving with an equation like this. The action angles, you can write it such that they still satisfy an equation just like they did before. This is the geodesic frequency as a function of the slowly evolving system parameters. Okay, so you take that expansion, you substitute it into the Einstein field equations, and the basic idea is wherever you see a time derivative, you replace that with a frequency plus something coming from the slow variation of these variables, these system parameters. And when you do this, the phases just factor out of the equations. So you had these phase factors, but they just entirely factor out. And your field equations here become, again, equations for the Fourier coefficients. Here I'm writing it in terms of a stress energy rather than a puncture, but same idea. And you get field equations like this for the Fourier coefficients. So the left-hand side looks exactly like it would look if you just did an ordinary discrete Fourier expansion. Right-hand side, we have the puncture term, and now we have this slow time derivative term coming from the slow variation of the system parameters. So something I keep trying to emphasize is that when we do this setup, the transformation from ordinary coordinates, ordinary coordinates on the world line, to these parameters J and these action angle variables, that's just what Martin was describing as a near identity averaging transformation. And you need to set that up before you can even write down these field equations. The outputs of those calculations go into this term, for example. And you in particular need to be using T as the basis for those variables, because that's what appears in the field equations. Okay, so how do you turn this into a waveform generation framework? Well, conceptually, it's pretty simple. You compute the amplitudes at infinity as a function of your orbital parameters or your system parameters. You calculate the frequencies as functions of the system parameters, and you calculate those driving forces that were driving the slow evolution of the system. So you do a sequence of calculations over the whole parameter space for different values of the system parameters, and then you just evolve through. And so you've got these guys stored, you've got these guys stored, you've got these guys stored, and then you just solve simple ODEs to generate this waveform. Okay, so the big picture is in place. But we're still cracking away at the simplest case, the quasi-circular case, which we've been working on for a long time. So this is something I've been working on with Barry Wardell, Niels Warburton, Jeremy Miller. And we put out our first paper with results a couple of years ago, and Niels will present new results later today. So this is still the same big picture, but just a little bit simpler. So the system parameters now, we don't have a whole list of three. We just have the azimuthal frequency plus the slow evolution of the big black hole. But this is basically just the same, but now we're doing an LM decomposition. So we're decomposing in spherical harmonics. And the only angle variable we have is just the azimuthal phase of the orbit. So the idea here is you're essentially moving from one circular orbit to the next. But it's important to emphasize that we are never setting the radial velocity to zero. The radial velocity is always non-zero. But we do a sequence of calculations for one value of frequency, another value of frequency, and so forth. Okay, so this was supposed to be the simple test case that we started working on in 2013. But it will never die. It's still going. But we are still generating new exciting results, I think. Okay, so unfortunately, I am going to have to go over time because I need to present these flowcharts, because this is going to set the stage for all the talks coming up through the next couple hours. So this is the setup for quasi-circular orbits in Schwarzschild in the Lorentz gauge, which is what we've been working on for 8 years now. But now I'm thinking of it as phase zero in a path towards doing the same thing in Kerr. So I presented the waveform generation framework in a very simple way, but behind the scenes, the hard part, of course, is doing the calculation at each value of the orbital parameters. And the biggest thing that we need to do is calculate the source in the second order field equations. That's the big hard part. So a bunch of things go in there. There's this second order Einstein tensor constructed from quadratic combinations of the first order field. There's the second order puncture, and there's these slow time derivatives. What I'm totally skipping over is that there's also a very complicated matching procedure that we use at Scribe Plus and at the horizon in order to get boundary conditions for our field equation. I'm not going to say anything about that. But Niels will present results for what comes out of eventually solving this equation once you've computed the source. And Leanne Durkin will present results specifically from the contribution that comes from this slow time derivative. So that's the piece coming from the slow evolution of the frequency. Okay, phase one. So that was phase zero, phase one. This is still Schwarzschild, but now we're going to use Tucholsky variables. Same idea, the hard part is calculating the source for the Tucholsky equation. And we're going to have a sequence of talks mostly presenting preliminary results for building up to eventually calculating the second order file scalar. So we need a piece coming from the second order Einstein tensor. Andrew Spires, my student, will talk about that. He'll talk about tweaking the gauge of the first order field to improve the behavior of this source, so make it better than it is in the Lorentz gauge. My student Sam Upton will talk about another tweak that, again, it makes an improvement of the source, this time near the particle, whereas this one is far away. Ben Leather is then going to talk about actually solving this equation. So we have some complicated source that's non-compact over the whole domain. And Ben will talk about solving the equation. Leanne's talk will cover this as well as Lorentz gauge stuff. And Chris will be talking about doing a post-Newtonian version of this calculation. And one application of that, sorry, I know I'm way over time. One application of that will be to make the calculation of this source much more efficient near the particle. Okay, last phase. Now, this is quasi-circular orbits in Kerr, Tucholsky. And you might think, why can't we just do exactly the same thing? The problem is that the first order field that's calculated in practice by, say, Martin's code is in this gauge called the no-strain gauge, which has a jump discontinuity across the particle. So it's got heavy side functions at the particle's radial position, and it's got a delta function. And so if you put that into this second order source and you get quadratic combinations, you get something that's not meaningful as a distribution, you can't solve the equation. So before we actually get to this stage, we have preliminary work, which is to get a better behaved first order field. So there will be a sequence of talks describing a couple ways of approaching that later this afternoon. All right, I will leave that up. I'm probably like 10 minutes over time now. I don't know, 3 minutes, that's fine. Okay, sorry for that.